Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Anna Karenina. What are we talking about? Part one, chapter five. I'm doing that thing where I forgot to open up the pages that I needed to do the podcast before I started doing the podcast. Because I'm smart like that. Now, Anna Karenina, Chapter 5. I asked you guys these questions. Too many new characters. I got confused. Sorry. Can anyone do a one-minute summary of this chapter? Yeah. Look, I'm just using the podcast and the community at this point to help me stay up to speed with the book. Sometimes, because I do the reading kind of scheduled, you know, I do it at around the same time every night. It just means that on the occasional night, maybe one in, one in 10, it just happens to be like, oh, I haven't done the podcast yet and got to go to bed soon, so I've got to do it now. But I'm really not in the headspace to read a book. You know, like, I wouldn't choose to read right now because I don't think I could pay attention, but I sort of have to because I've left it to the last, and like the last thing I do at the end of the day. Yesterday was one of those days, and because it was a chapter where we had a whole lot of new characters and new things going on, and a lot was introduced, I struggled to take it all in just because I was quite tired and wasn't in the right headspace for it. So I've just gone ahead and used the Hemingway List community to help fill me in. And that's what's so awesome about this community, is that if you do find you miss something or you need a bit of clarity around a certain chapter or a certain plot event, we're all here, you know. You don't have to go back and reread it. You can just say, hey, can someone explain this to me? I kind of didn't get it. And I don't know. I think that's really cool. Also, a big event happened yesterday. I forgot to mention it last night in the podcast, but Project Tolstoy, secret project codename Tolstoy, the let's just say the first draft of Project Tolstoy was completed yesterday. Whoops, sorry, bumped the microphone. First draft complete, which means I reckon we're maybe a week away from launch. I'm not going to lock that in. Roughly a week away. I don't want to have to rush anything. I do have a pretty busy week with Launchpad, my school program that I run. So anyway, you guys don't know what that is because I'm keeping it a secret. Project Tolstoy, it's a big secret. I thought about, you know, when it's... My idea is when it's ready and you guys can sort of, you know, immediately check it out, the project, then I'll announce what it is. But I didn't want to, like, hype it and say what it is in the lead-up. I thought, what if I just, what if I announce it and be like, boom, it's also ready to go. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to announce what it is until it's ready to be released. Is that hype? I don't know. Are you guys hyped? Probably not, because you don't know what it is. I'm just trying something new. Project Tolstoy. I've been working on it for a good 4 months, and it's nearly ready for you guys. I'm really excited. What is Oblonsky's job? Is he at work? That's the other question I asked you guys. And the third discussion prompt was general discussion. Little Birdie. Oh, Little Birdie with these awesome in-depth comments. Every day. Little Birdie, you need to take it easy. You're going to burn yourself out. You're writing like an essay every day. And hey, I'm not saying I don't appreciate it. These are really, really well thought out and quite awesome. But it's a lot of work for you. Little Birdie 8612 said, here we get to see Oblonsky in society outside of the domestic sphere. And it's very clear that he thrives outside of the home. But this also gives Tolstoy the chance to criticize Russian society for its corrupted values. We see that despite Oblonsky's life of dissipation, his rather low rank, and his not very advanced age, he was able to obtain a highly distinguished, lucrative position in Moscow's government offices. Oblonsky has been able to achieve power and respect, not because of intellect or experience, but through his brother-in-law. Tolstoy criticizes the government for placing societal connections above true ability. In their social climate, it's obviously about who you know, not what you know. Very much that was the case in War and Peace. It was all about who you know, not what you know. Big theme of the book. But Russian society also emphasizes conformity in its balance of power. All Oblonsky has to do as an official was not raise objections or be envious, nor to quarrel or take offense. Individuality in both political offices and social situations was discouraged. Should Oblonsky stray from popular opinions, he would very likely lose his job. At the same time, if an individual were to renounce social principles and act against what was expected of them by their peers, they would be ostracized from their social circle. This will be a major struggle for the novel's protagonists. All of this is about the importance of maintaining appearances before the public. Tolstoy conveys this through a rather literal representation. Oblonsky is esteemed by his colleagues for his handsome, bright appearance, his sparkling eyes, black hair and eyebrows, and pink and white complexion. Oblonsky has a high place in a society for his physical appearance, thus the person is respected in the social sphere as long as their outward behavior conforms to the image of good society. We almost can't blame Oblonsky for being as shallow and superficial as he is. He's just a product of Russian society in Moscow, and according to Tolstoy, all of society is guilty for placing value on conformity and appearances rather than characters and morals. Yet Tolstoy goes further by making this a quality that is distinct to Moscow and the city with the introduction of Levin, who is from the country. Anna Karenina is spiritually autobiographical, and Tolstoy communicates many of his own inward experiences, moral conflicts, and ideas through Levin's story. Whereas Oblonsky endeavors to please everyone and is always good-natured, Levin is always agitated and in a hurry, a little embarrassed and irritated. Levin tries to please no one in society and is a hardcore individualist. He gave up his post in the rural council when he didn't agree with its lack of progress, thus embodying Tolstoy's own value of nonconformity. Levin's disdain for societal sloth is shown by his preoccupation with Grinevich's hands. Those in political office with delicate hands were able to grow their nails long and wear expensive cufflinks because they never have to use their hands for work. Levin can't distract himself from the fact that no strenuous effort is required from Moscow's political leaders. It makes such sense, since, as a landowner, Levin is used to physical labor from his own workers. Hard work and efforts were important to Tolstoy. To him, a person needs some work to feel fulfilled in life, much in the same way a person needs love to be happy. Tolstoy makes another important distinction between the urban and rural society. In describing Levin, whose home is in the country, Oblonsky cries, "Everything before him, and what incredible vitality, not like some of us." Meanwhile, Oblonsky relents that he's in an awful mess at the end of the chapter. Levin, happy and apparently carefree in the country, while Oblonsky is stressed, though not from work. To Tolstoy, the country represented moral simplicity, while the city represented moral and emotional complexity. Oblonsky's fight with his wife. Obviously, Tolstoy believes in the former as the way of life. Later in the novel, the dichotomy between rural and urban moral values becomes more prevalent as passionate conflicts take place in the city and Levin's story becomes one of emotional relief. Whew, wow. And there's more beyond that, but I might skip to another responder here because, you know what? So much work goes into these responses, little birdie, that I feel bad reading them on the podcast because it's like you put more effort into that than I did. Clearly. So, I don't know. Thank you. I was just thinking as I was reading that, like, there's this guy, Brian E. Denton, who is quite well known over in the A Year of War and Peace community because he has a blog called A Year of War and Peace where he has created a blog entry for every single chapter of the book War and Peace with a little bit of analysis, a little bit of a comparison to the famous Stoic philosophers and some quotes that relate to the chapter. It's a good little companion blog for the book, you can, chapter by chapter. If you did a little essay like this for every single chapter, you could publish something like that too and have a chapter analysis for the whole book, for sure. Courtiot said, Oblonsky is a government official. At work, he is visited by his old friend Konstantin Levin, who lives in the countryside. Levin is in love with Dolly's younger sister, Kitty Shcherbatskaya. Oblonsky and Levin decide to meet for dinner later the same day. All right, there we go. I missed that detail that Levin is in love with, Oblonsky's sister-in-law. At work, he is visited by an old friend, Konstantin Levin, who lives in the countryside. Yeah, cool. Soma Stars said, character spreadsheet is updated. Go and check out the character spreadsheet if you're struggling to remember who's who. You can find it on the Hemingway List subreddit. Lomike91 said, an important character will be Levin and Kitty. It's interesting to me how Levin and Oblonsky are described. We have a long description of Oblonsky and how he was able to get his job and how good he is in acquiring relation and keep them alive, despite being a normal man without big talents. Then we have Levin. I guess the best word to describe him is shy, as the novel kept saying, a real man from the countryside, more keen on outdoor activities and agriculture than paperwork. Both men don't understand each other, but yet they're able to and want to spend time and discuss about the world together. We have now another line of the story. What Levin really wants and why he is that interested on Shcherbatsky's family. Format Kaka said, Oblonsky is an extremely indulgent person. This is mainly because he never had the need to use his brain. This can be noticed from multiple situations, like to get a job and keep it, he had only not to refuse things, not to sow jealousy, not to be quarrelsome or take offense, all of which, from his characteristic good nature, he never did. And his work ethic, never tried, never failed. His complete indifference to the business in which he was engaged, in consequence of which he was never carried away and never made mistakes. Sarcasm is used in the initial part of the chapter. It says that everyone was delighted with Oblonsky every day. They loved him, good-humoured deference. People in the office definitely aren't so dumb to get so delighted by Oblonsky. It probably is because he is so agreeable and he has contacts in the government. People want to keep friendships with him and take advantage of the situation if and when it arises. It can be said that Oblonsky helped people in the past because people are still delighted with him. Hard to be delighted with someone so dumb for so long if you can't expect anything out of them. Levin and Oblonsky's relationship dynamic was amusing and pretty confusing. It seems like they detest each other. Oblonsky, probably because he doesn't have the courage to pick a career choice like Levin, and Levin probably hates Oblonsky's guts. Please correct me if I am wrong. Little Birdie did correct him, saying, I don't think they hate each other. They're just two old friends who now have different lives, and I think they try their best to respect each other. Levin's just not very good at it because he's not naturally good-natured like Oblonsky. All right, very interesting. Al Treat said, the only one new character that stands out to me at this point is Levin. I think we are introduced to three of his colleagues, but so far none of them have distinguished themselves to me enough to commit their names and relationships to memory. Glad to have that character spreadsheet. In my translation, Oblonsky's job, he refers to himself as chairman. Levin derisively refers to what he does as paperwork. It seems he's a bureaucrat. Although today's scene takes place in the building where he exercises his post, it seems Levin doesn't think it is an actual job with actual work. I don't understand what you do. How can you do it seriously? It's mentioned that he knows how to make it pleasant, and as the report is read, his eyes are laughing as he thinks private thoughts about what a guilty boy he's been. So it seems that while he's at work, doing work, he may not be fully present. General discussion. I'm not really a fan of the way Oblonsky treats people. His whole interaction with Levin seems to be comprised of needling him and feeling smugly superior. He doesn't want to listen to what his secretary is actually saying and sends him off abashed when he goes in to ask about something. But he's also doing it in such a nice or personable way that the people he's talking to feel themselves to be lacking. Although, with how self-absorbed we've seen him already, maybe Steve's effect on people is unintentional rather than purposely trying to embarrass them or make them uncomfortable. Alright. John T. Adams said the whole first half of the chapter is raining praise on Oblonsky. Nobody is mad at Oblonsky because Oblonsky rules and Dolly drools. I sound like I'm joking, but based on this chapter, everyone in Oblonsky's house is on his side because everyone loves this guy. I bet that Dolly begins to look more and more negative. Also, in the same way Levin in his heart despised the town mode of life of his friend and his official duties, which he laughed at and regarded as trifling, but the difference was that Oblonsky, as he was doing the same as everyone did, laughed complacently and good-humouredly, whole Levin laughed without complacency and sometimes angrily, while Levin laughed without complacency and sometimes angrily. Taken in context of that whole paragraph, this is a pretty deep comment, albeit somewhat outside the scope of this book. Dr. Nature asked a question. Anyone here highlighting text in the book, passages or phrases? Just curious, if you are, what have you been highlighting? No one has answered that so far, but I'd be really interested to hear if people are pulling out the old highlighter and marking down any of the sentences. Good question. I Am Norwegian said, is the title of Prince considered a modest rank? This chapter paints a picture of an entitled man who feels that he has a right to whatever his peers have. He would have found it ridiculous to not have an extremely well-paid government job to fall into his lap, but again, something good peeks out. He is competent and egalitarian, perhaps not surprising given his liberal views, but there's plenty of people who advocate equality as long as they don't have to deal with the poor directly, who would shudder at the thought of actually acting out their beliefs. I think Prince is a fairly modest rank. Doesn't mean prince as in like the son of the king sort of thing. Prince was just like a word for like a noble person. But it doesn't imply that they own anything of value, meaning land or resources. So that would be like a count or a duke or potentially a prince as well, but I do know that in War and Peace, I think basically everyone in the book is called prince, and some of them are poor, some of them are well off. It doesn't really seem to mean that they're like super elite. Although saying that, they all are part of like high society, so I suppose they're all, you know, none of them are peasants or serfs or even working class, really. So I suppose it's not exactly modest when you look at it through that lens. But modest, when you think of the whole cast of the book, is probably all high society, then modest in that realm. All right, I think we should read the next chapter, chapter 6, which goes a little bit like this. One second when I find the page. It's a very short chapter. All right. Chapter 6. When Oblonsky asked Levin his reason for coming to town, Levin had blushed and been angry with himself for blushing, because he could not answer. I have come to propose to your sister-in-law, although he really had come solely for that purpose. The Levins and the Shcherbatskys were two old aristocratic Moscow families that had always been on intimate and friendly terms. Their ties were drawn still closer during Levin's university days. He had prepared for and entered the university together with Prince Shcherbatsky, Dolly and Kitty's brother. At that time, Levin often visited the Shcherbatskys and fell in love with the family, especially the feminine half of it, that Levin was in love with. He could not remember his mother, and his sister was much his senior, so that in the Shcherbatskys' house he saw for the first time the family life of a well-educated and honourable family, of the old aristocracy, a life such as he had been deprived of by the death of his own father and mother. All the members of that family, especially the women, appeared to him as though wrapped in some mystic, poetic veil, and he not only saw no defects in them, but imagined, behind that poetic veil, the loftiest feelings and every possible perfection. Why these three young ladies had to speak French and English on alternate days, why at a given time they played, each in her turn, on the piano, the sound of which reached their brother's room, where the students were at work, why those masters of French literature, music, drawing, and dancing came to the house, why at certain hours the three young ladies, accompanied by Mademoiselle Linon, were driven in the caliche to the Tverskoy Boulevard, wearing satin cloaks, Dolly a long one, Natalie a somewhat shorter one, and Kitty so short a cloak that her shapely little legs, in their tight red stockings, were quite exposed, why they had to walk up and down the Tverskoy Boulevard, accompanied by a footman with a gilt cockade in his hat, all this and much more that happened in this mystic world he did not understand. But he knew that everything done there was beautiful, and he was in love with the very mystery of it all. In his student days, he never nearly fell in love with the eldest daughter, Dolly. He very nearly fell in love with the eldest daughter, Dolly, but a marriage was soon after arranged between her and Oblonsky. Then he began falling in love with the second daughter. He seemed to feel that he must fall in love with one of the sisters, but he was not sure of which. But Natalie, too, as soon as she came out, married the diplomat Lvov. Kitty was still a child when Levin finished at the university. Young Shcherbatsky, who entered the navy, was drowned in the Baltic, and after that, in spite of his friendship with Oblonsky, Levin's intercourse with the Shcherbatskys became less frequent. But when he had come to Moscow early in the winter of this year and met them, he knew at last which of the three sisters he was really fated to love. It would seem that nothing could be simpler than for him, a man of good family, rich rather than poor, and 32 years of age, to propose to the Princess Shcherbatskaya. In all likelihood, he would have been considered quite a suitable match, but Levin was in love, and therefore Kitty seemed to him so perfect in every respect, so transcending everything earthly, and he seemed to himself so very earthly and insignificant a creature, that the possibility of his being considered worthy of her by others or by herself was to him unimaginable. Having spent 2 months in Moscow living as in a fog, meeting Kitty almost every day in society, which he began to frequent in order to meet her, he suddenly made up his mind that it was impossible and returned to the country. Levin's conviction that it was impossible rested on the idea that from her relative's point of view, he was not a good or suitable match for the delightful Kitty, and that Kitty herself could not love him. From her parents' standpoint, it seemed to him, he had no settled occupation or position in the world. He was 32, and while his former comrades were already colonels, aides-de-camp, bank and railway directors or heads of government boards like Oblonsky, he knew very well what others must think of him, was merely a country squire, spending his time breeding cows, shooting snipe, and erecting buildings. That is to say, a fellow without talent who had come to no good and was only doing what, in the opinion of society, good-for-nothing people always do. Of course, the mysterious, enchanting Kitty could not love a plain fellow, such as he considered himself to be. A man so ordinary and undistinguished. Moreover, his former relation to Kitty had been that of a grown-up man toward a child whose brother's friend he was, and this seemed an additional obstacle in love's path. He thought a plain, kindly fellow like himself might be loved as a friend, But to be loved with the kind of love he felt for Kitty, a man must be handsome, and above all, remarkable. He had heard that women often love plain, ordinary men, but he did not believe it, because he judged by himself, and he could only love beautiful, mysterious, exceptional women. But after spending 2 months alone in the country, he became convinced that this time he was not in love as he had been when quite young, for his present feelings gave him not a moment's rest, and that he could not live unless the question whether she was to be his wife or not was decided. Also, that his despair had been the outcome of his own fancy, and that he had no proof that he would be rejected. So, he had now come to Moscow determined to propose to her and to marry her if he was accepted, but he dared not think what would happen if she refused him. All right, there we go. That was chapter 6 of Anna Karenina. Very cool. Quick reminder, just real quick, about the Patreon page. Big thanks to all my Patreon subscribers for helping me out with supporting the podcast. If you want to do the same, you can donate whatever value you think the podcast is sort of worth to you, whatever value you get out of it. Of course, you're more than welcome to keep listening for free, but I do appreciate it when someone decides to flick me a little bit of support. You can do $1 per month, so that's about 30 episodes for a dollar. Not bad. You could do $30 a month, $1 per episode. It's really up to you how much you want to contribute. I will say there is no prizes sent out or anything. You do get access to some exclusive content, little blog posts and stuff like that. But really, it's just a way for you to, as a token of gratitude, I suppose, support the podcast. So I know there's some Patreon pages where you get rewards sent out to you and stuff like that, and then there's others where it's just a way to support the artist. This is more that one, because I figured I'm putting work into this every single day, so I didn't really want to then, you know, create more work for myself by sending things out or, you know, mucking around with envelopes and that kind of thing. But yeah, that's what it is. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList if you're interested in supporting the show. Other than that, Project Tolstoy is coming. Very excited about that. Thank you for listening to today's episode, and I'll see you tomorrow.